keeping with the theme of thick annular eclipses. John Westfall is now going to speak to us on transits of Mercury and Venus. It occurred to me that there may be beaded phenomena with the transit of Mercury, but I don't think anybody's actually started to look for it. Daniel, there's your next challenge. Dr. Westfall is an emeritus professor of geography at San Francisco State University, but he's probably better known in the astronomical community as the coordinator of the transit section of ALPO, the Association of Near Planetary Observers. And I think probably just the perfect person to talk to us about this next subject.
I've finally been convinced to use PowerPoint. I've been an overhead transparency man for a number of years. And just for this presentation, I learned the technique of filling the entire frame with my graphics, which probably I shouldn't have learned. I'm going to be talking about a subject that perhaps some of you should consider, or might consider off list. Transits aren't eclipses, are they? I will get to that momentarily. But I'm talking about today is the current period, the current 20 years, where we have more of these transits occurring than the statistical average. Between 1999 and 2019, we have 7 transits, 2 of Venus, which are pretty darn rare, and 5 of Mercury. 4 of these transits are now history, but 3 are yet to come. And let's see, what's remarkable about some of these? Of course, all transits are remarkable about that. 1999 was a rare grace transit where Mercury did not fully enter the disk of the Sun or the areas in the South Pacific. 2003, Mercury, that was a handy transit because its timing was very close to the timing of the 2004 Venus transit. So, at least for myself, it was a chance to find a good site for 2004. If I could see the transit of Mercury well in 2003, and the weather cooperated, I probably would see it quite well at that spot the next year. 2006, of course, was the most recent one, just late last year. Then Venus, 2012 is your last chance, unless we have medical breakthroughs, because it'll be 21-17 till the next. And then there are 2 more Mercury transits coming up, somewhat similarly timed, visible from similar longitudes. And then there is a long gap until 2032. Till the next transit of any sort, in this case, a transit of Mercury. Okay, now a little terminology here. I have come to the conclusion that there's no difference between an eclipse and a transit. All eclipses are not only hybrid eclipses, but they're also transits, as long as we free our minds from the tired cliche that you have to be on the Earth's surface. Of course, people have used balloons to see eclipses, and now they use high-flying aircraft. But also, these recent transits were notable because we had images from space. So, what do you call something like this? That's the moon there, and that's the sun. Is that a transit or is that an eclipse? It all depends on the observer's location. And I think what we need to do, we need our terminology cleared up, and I think we should take it to the IAU. Oops, I skipped ahead a bit. Okay, just a little astronomy 101. But transits, like I say, are really a form of eclipse, so you know all these terms, right? The the object you want to see pass in front of the sun, well, you have to be near the node of its orbit. The object has to be at inferior conjunction, which means it's between you and the sun. And I would guess during a solar eclipse, you could say the moon is in inferior conjunction. Trouble is it doesn't have any superior conjunction, just like the planets from Mars out. They only have superior conjunctions. But, okay, the Mercury transit in the current epoch, you're going to be near the node either in roughly near Armistice Day. Oh, we don't call it that anymore, do we? Sorry. Veterans Day. Or near within a few days of May 9th. With Mercury, which node makes a difference? About a 20% difference in the angular diameter of the planet. And what's this weird differential parallax? Well, we used to use transits as a way of determining the value of the astronomical unit, roughly speaking, the mean distance from the Earth to the Sun. And we did that by observing the shift of the planet's position on the face of the Sun as seen from different points on the Earth. I have found it rarely mentioned that, gee, the Sun shifts as well. And what you are really measuring is the difference between the parallax of the planet and the parallax of the sun. And that makes a big difference. As soon as I find all my buttons here. Makes a big difference between Mercury's differential parallax and Venus's differential parallax. Prior to the 1761 transit of Venus, it was thought that, well, we don't have to wait so long. We can measure the solar parallax using transits of Mercury, and it just didn't work out whatsoever. Some claim the results of the Venus parallax were disappointing, but they certainly were a heck of a lot better than trying to use Mercury. Here's a panorama of the transits for the current two centuries, not the current two decades. And there are 30 transits. Just two of Venus and 28 of Mercury. And doing some heavy math, that would seem to lead to an expectation of three transits on the average in 20 years. And instead, we have seven of them. Never was any one. And here's the sun, the subject of target practice. That's all seven transits plotted out as seen from the center of the Earth. The broad bands are Venus, and the narrow ones are Mercury. And there you get a real feel for the difference in size between the two bodies. And here's that unusual 1999 Graves transit of Mercury, seen from the center of the Earth that barely got inside the disk of the Sun. And rather than plot out what would it be 21 different visibility zones on the same map to show where on Earth you could see, could have seen or will be able to see these transits, I plotted out where the Sun will be in the zenith at mid-transit. And you can figure, on the average, that people for about 60 degrees of longitude on either side, comprising roughly a third of the Earth, will be able to see the whole thing. And then add a sixth of the Earth to the east, well, they'll just be able to see it. Let me make sure I get it right. Ingress. And another sixth of the Earth where they'll be able to see egress, the end, the beginning and the end. That makes two-thirds of the Earth where people will be able to see at least some part of a transit. And we have seven of them spread rather generously in longitude. So there's no excuse during these 20 years not to see a transit. Don't blame it on your weather, of course. Now, just a couple interesting correspondences on this map. Here is the 2003 Mercury and the 2004 Venus, and you can see how close they were. I consider that a pure coincidence. Maybe someone deeply into celestial mechanics can show some sort of synchronicity between Mercury and Venus, and come to think of it, the Earth as well, but it's beyond me. Here, though, involving just two November transits of Mercury is a suspicious correspondence, very close. And if time allows, I'll get a bit into that correspondence later. I should have pointed out something that's probably obvious to all of you, that those November transits, and by the way, also to Venus, which aren't shown here, are going to be in the southern hemisphere. Pardon me?
You need a mic closer.
Oh, okay, sorry. And it's apparently actually working. So those transits favor the southern hemisphere, and the May and June ones favor the northern hemisphere. I'm not going into detail about all those, all seven transits, but like I say, 1999 was a bit unusual, thank you. Here it is, north at the top, grazing the north limb of the sun. A little more detail on that for black drop aficionados. That little filament that is frequently observed connecting the limb of the planet with the limb of the sun. Which is simply a blurring phenomenon. There's nothing occult about it, despite the somewhat ominous name. And it was very prolonged at this transit, because even in the zone where you could see the whole transit, Mercury moved very slowly inwards and very slowly outwards. If you were down here, Mercury didn't make it all the way in. And I'm curious, is there anyone in the audience who saw this as a partial transit? It looks like they had bad weather just about everywhere in Australia and New Zealand. I got no firsthand reports from down there. Well, you figure, no big deal. We had a partial transit, a grazing transit in 1937, 1999. That's not too long. We don't have to wait very long. Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm afraid you do. And then, of course, a very widely observed June transit of Venus. First transit of Venus since 1882, and I don't think I have it noted here, the first June transit since 1769, when the Spanish were just starting to found the missions in California. Let's see, what else might be said? Millions of people saw it. It was televised. Everybody seemed to have a webcast of it. Widespread amateur and professional participation. First transit of Venus to be recorded electronically. Plenty of photographs were taken of the 19th century transits, but of course, no digital imaging. First to be observed from satellites, including peculiar wavelengths, like the UV here. Some excellent professional telescopes, like the 1 meter Swedish Solar Telescope, the Gong Network, the helioseismology people, three of their stations observed the transit, and gee whiz, they proved there is some parallax. Great. Also, and I don't think this was remarked even with the earlier transits, that Venus's atmosphere created an aureole of light around the planet. Sure, that was known. But a brightening near its south pole. I think possibly that might mean that the cloud layer is a little bit lower there. But that became evident by comparing different images during this transit. Couple even seeing arrows. And by the way, that rather spectacular aureole was also imaged by amateurs. using, looks like probably a C-14. I'm interested mainly for historical reasons in the accuracy of timings of the four contacts. And by the way, the four contacts with a transit are the same as with a solar eclipse, so I don't have to explain that. And of the rather few timings I got directly for the transit of Venus, it looks like systematic biases come in there. Contact 2 timed early, but what can you say with only 4? Contact 3 definitely timed a bit late. Contact 4 definitely timed a bit early. It looks like that aureole may have affected the timings of contacts 1, 2, and that black drop effect maybe made contact 4 noticeably early. And notice, by the way, roughly the order of the errors, like the biases, I should say, minus 80 seconds here. What is that? Plus 60 seconds there. Switching to the 2006 transit of Mercury, you can see that the spread is much smaller. You don't have an aureole possibly confusing the results. And also, the planet is moving much faster relative to its own diameter. So it looks like still contact 1, quite a bit, noticeably late. Plus means late, minus early. Contact 2, statistically no significant error in that. Contact 3, though, a little bit late. Contact 4, a little bit early. And by the way, I should have mentioned with, in fact, I can back up with this, right? Wondrous technology. The ESO conducted a program of visual timings of this transit. I believe they got over 4,000 timings. I prefer not to say much about their overall result, about the parallax, but they do have this body of over 4,000 timings that I am slowly plowing through and try to look for biases in the results there. All right, let's turn to the future, 2012. For once, the transit not visible is not centered on California. What do you know? But how about where you can see the whole thing? All right, it is, roughly speaking, the Pacific Basin and East Asia. Australia comes out fairly well, although this is a June transit, so the sun will be, it'll be during their winter time. Hawaii and Alaska are the only places in the United States that, in theory, can see the whole thing, but all of North America and part of South America will be able to see at least the beginning of the transit. Most of Europe will be able to see at least the end of the transit here. So I'm guessing, I would say about 90% of mankind is in the zone where they can see at least some of it. How about those Mercury transits coming up? They're centered on the Atlantic Basin. The May transit, of course, favors the Northern Hemisphere. But again, about two-thirds of the Earth will be able to see at least some of that transit. And similarly, for the 2019 transit, centered on the Atlantic Basin. But again, the great majority of the Earth will be able to see at least some of that, somewhat favoring the Southern Hemisphere, particularly South America. Now, how am I doing? I actually have 10 minutes. Oh, I might even have time for questions. But I wanted to talk about the correspondences between some transits of Mercury, the November transits, that I noted two transits occurring quite similarly in terrestrial location in terms of where the sun was at mid-transit. So I went through John Mayus's excellent booklet titled Simply Transits, where he has tables on the Venus or Mercury transits from 1605 to 2295 and plotted them out. May transits here, November transits here. Actually, yeah, if you go with the Julian calendar, some of them are even October. I'm sorry you can't read the dates, but I think this book's still in print. Look at the tables yourself, and you see they fall in definite groups, spaced about 24 degrees in longitude each. So there seems to be a definite pattern, a long-term pattern, I should mention, involving these November transits of Mercury. Here we get a little more abstract. There seems to be a 230-year period, so I divided the dates by 230 and plotted the ephemeris times of the event, and they're spaced by 1.6-hour intervals, which is 24 degrees of terrestrial longitude. And to make that a little clearer, I did a little modular arithmetic in terms of the phase of the 230-year period. And here they group up rather clearly. Notice the 1.6-hour spacing. And, of course, a 46-year period for Venus transits, Mercury transits has been known for a long time, pointed out in a number of books and articles. But what hasn't been, what happened? Thank you. But what hasn't been pointed out, to my knowledge, is that those transits 46 years apart are spaced also 1.6 hours apart in ephemeris time, which is close to UT, or 24 degree, or no, pardon me, I'm off by factor of three. They're spaced 72 degrees apart in terrestrial longitude, 4.8 hours, which means you take five of those 46-year cycles, 230 years, and the transit comes back to virtually the same place on the Earth. And so here is one of Mayhew's series of transits. I believe it's the E series. And I'm having trouble reading my own screen, so let me see if I have it in the notes. And yes, that's a series E. It starts in 1776. I'm not being patriotic. It just happens to start there. Add 46 years, you got 1822, 1868. And before you know it, you're at 2006, and you have made a full circuit of the Earth, but you're not done yet. Here it goes again. The lines are simply to illustrate, to connect them, so you can keep track. And that keeps up till 2486, hitting the same area on the Earth. And that's part of the coincidence. But all the series of Mercury transits in November, not in May, favor those areas. And this is the point where somebody will say, well, that's well known. You're evidently ignorant of so-and-so's article in 1872 on the subject. But I have run across no mention of this in the literature, the remarkable tie-in between the axis of Mercury and terrestrial locations. And I certainly welcome any comments from anybody who has heard of such a thing, this 230-year period on November transits of Mercury, which I should mention are about two-thirds of the transits of Mercury. About one-third occur in May, about two-thirds occur in November, and this is the first time in living memory I seem to have finish the topic ahead of time. So if we have a few minutes left, I would be happy to answer any questions.
I realize the conspiracy theorist seeing a Pentagon center. Here we have a question.
Yes, sir.
Yes. In Archetria, on the transit of Venus, we observed, several of us observed a central spot in the planet on both the ingress and egress. And we have seen diagrams of that central spot in some of the drawings in the 18th century. But we thought that that was merely someone's compass drive, you know, poking a spot. But I didn't see very many on the web for any of that being imaged. And has there been any explanation as to what that central spot
is? Yeah, I haven't seen any images either. I know in the 19th century, central spots, I think, were more frequently reported, at least in terms of percentage of reports, and also occasionally for Mercury. Now, with Venus, the only explanation I can think of that is originates with the planet would be its atmosphere and some sort of refractive effect.
I find that hard to believe that it would go 90 degrees and come out.
Right. But, you know, with the occultation of 28 Sagittarii by Titan, the central flash, well, a flash was observed when the star was directly opposite the observer, 180 degrees. So possibly an atmosphere can create an effect like that, but I'm suspicious because it was occasionally reported for Mercury.
Yeah, and we didn't see it in the earlier. We tried to get an image in 2006, didn't see it, but also we didn't see it anywhere between central contact. So
I think it's more likely to be in the telescope than in transit.
Now, we have central spots in the transit in the occultations of Pluto. I'll say something about that, too.
Okay.
I'd be very interested to talk to you later and the actual intensity. But you can account for that focusing. But you have to be very precisely along. So it was possible that in one you were and the other you weren't quite.
Yeah, of course, with a solar transit, some spot of the sun is directly opposite you. But remember, you're observing through a very heavy filter. I would doubt you'd get a bright enough central spot to report. I think there might have been at least one other.
Just a comment on that. And the 2004 Venus transit from the trace data in the white light channel, the spacecraft data, the image contrast was achieved is about 10 to the minus 5th solar in terms of surface brightness. Mm-hmm. And there was no brightening at all central spot measurements in any of those space data.
Okay, well, that seemed to be rather definitive.
One more question?
Just a remark. If John Mias doesn't know about this, then no one does. I think you should publish it.
But then I will find out that indeed he did publish it.
Send him a pre-pub cop for review.
Yeah, that's probably the wisest move.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.